CFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The head of the German Secret Service has been forced to resign as he was found to have been covering up for a neo-Nazi terror group. And closer to home, Bristol Remploy, which provides jobs for disabled people, may not be forced to close now. We get the lowdown from two of the workers, Michelle Tyler and Mark Cambridge. Also, rank and file officers in Avon and Somerset Police say the force is being robbed blind by the coalition government, who are using red tape to withhold £20 million from our policing budget, which would add up to 450 more police on the streets. And Bristol's Railways, the true story of how First Great Western is profiteering off our need to get around and to get to work, and also mismanaging Bristol's Railways. Dave Ridgewell is here from CIRA. Plus, Martin Summers' weekly roundup of world events. And I think that's where we'll start, Martin, this week. Now, we've had a terrible bomb attack in the Syrian capital Damascus on Wednesday, which killed the Minister of Defence in the Assad government. Have you any thoughts about that? And, you know, what are the implications of it? Because it comes at the same time as we've got a Security Council meeting and a possible resolution being passed or put forward anyway by the United States against the Assad government, calling for sanctions against them.
Well, I mean, I think it's fairly clear when you have a bomb attack that kills two generals and a top security official that you're not dealing with peaceful protesters peacefully demanding change in Syria. It's absolutely clear that what we've got is an all-out civil war. Now, some people believe in violence as a way to change society, some people don't. But let's be absolutely clear what's going on here. The Western powers are quite clear in their backing for armed rebellion against the Syrian regime and all the consequences that flow from that. And therefore, the Syrian regime and its backers in Russia, China, Iran and Lebanon and Iraq are saying, well, we're not prepared to accept that as a legitimate kind of way to do business, so we're at war.
Well, we haven't.
And of course,
the
potential is that this is going to turn into a general war.
Well, we haven't heard a lot about the actual individuals killed there. These two generals, particularly General Dawood Raja, is a Syrian Orthodox Christian. He took over as defence minister in Syria last August after his predecessor, Ali Habib Mahmoud, stepped down due to health problems. Before assuming the post, Raja, who was in his mid-60s, served as an army chief of staff. He was the most senior Christian official in the Syrian government and the highest-ranking official so far to be killed in the conflict. Raja has been accused as the architect behind the violent crackdown that the Assad regime has led against these armed demonstrators. Just hours after the attack at the Syrian the National Security Building in Damascus that claimed Raja's life, Assad appointed Fajad Jassim al-Fred to replace him as defence minister. The other chap that was killed is General Hassan Turkmani, a former defence minister. Turkmani, until his death, was serving as an assistant to the country's vice president. In his mid-70s, Turkmani, a Sunni Muslim, was close to the regime and took part in the crackdown against the uprising as the head of a cell dedicated to crisis operations. A career military man, Turkmani served as a commander during the Yom Kippur War in 1973 and was appointed chief of staff of the Syrian army in 2002. Shortly after the revolt began in March last year, Assad sent Turkmani to Turkey for talks with officials there. So these are two very high-ranking people, Martin. Where do you think that this is heading, this conflict in Syria? Because,
well,
it's not very easy to penetrate the headquarters of the security forces.
No,
and
there are suggestions that Western intelligence services help with this hit. They're not saying anything, but it seems like there's a very high level of skill involved in doing something like this. There's also suggestions that it may have been a drone strike rather than a suicide bomb. What's happening is everybody's lying to us. The Syrian government are lying, the West's lying, the Qatari and Saudis are quite openly supplying weaponry to the rebels. Of course, what should happen in Qatar and Saudi Arabia, of course, where they don't have any elections at all, is that their generals should be bombed, shouldn't they? This is the logic of this. If we're going to support armed uprisings in Syria, and clearly we are, that's the position of William Hague, saying, as a result of this bomb, it's all getting out of control, we've got to actually push Assad out. So let's say the same for the Bahraini government, the Saudi government, the Qatari government, all of these unelected monarchies in the Gulf. There's got to be an armed uprising against them, and we're not going to be pussyfooting around. These people are going to have to be bombed, shot, stuck up the backside with a bayonet like Gaddafi and shot in the head, because that's Western policy. We believe in armed rebellion against repressive regimes, no matter what the cost, no matter what the price, no matter who dies, no matter how much blood flows. As long as we get a democratic election at the end, then fight we must. And the first people we've got to fight are the Saudi monarchy and their allies in the West, who are allied with them.
But you see,
they are also in fascist dictators, aren't they? Of course they are.
In Syria, they have actually recently had a referendum on the constitution.
They did indeed, in which 60% of the people participated and voted for government candidates. Now, the idea that Assad has got no popular support at all is wrong. He's also got the support of the democratically elected government of Lebanon. He's got the support of the Iraqi government, which is democratically elected, supposedly. He's got the support of the Iranians. He's got the support of the Russians. He's got the support of the Chinese. Now, the British and the Americans and the Israelis don't like that. But, of course, that could end up being World War III. And if people in this country want World War III, let's carry on down the road that the coalition is taking us down. The banks are going down before the end of the summer, and we're going to war in the Middle East. Everybody ready for this now? Because, of course, if we are going to bomb people in the Middle East like we did in Libya, they might come and bomb us. So people be ready for that. Yeah? They're getting in the tube stations during the Olympics, get ready for the bomb attacks on us, since we're bombing them.
Well, there
come
was
on,
a...
let's not be cowardly here. You know, we believe in war. Let's have a proper war.
Now, this week, the UN Security Council met, and a resolution was put forward by the US, which was calling for sanctions on Syria, and also that the Syrian government, Assad's government, desist from using the army actually domestically. But David Cameron didn't like that. He's our Prime Minister, and this is what he had to say.
I don't think any regime that carries out acts as they have against their own citizens, and continue to do so, by the way, should survive. I think that regime should go. So the message to President Assad is it is time for transition, it is time for you to go. The message to President Putin, who I discussed this with at the G8 in Mexico, and the message to all those on the UN Security Council, it is time for the UN Security Council to pass clear and tough messages about sanctions, I believe under Chapter 7 of the UN, and to be unambiguous in this. Now, obviously, we are a UN Security Council with permanent members, and permanent members that have vetoes. We can't pass these things without everybody stepping up to the plate and taking the right action. But I would appeal to those who in the past have held out against tough action against Syria, that, you know, what more evidence do we need about a regime that has brutalized its own people? And as I say, the alternative to political transition at the top of Syria is revolution from the bottom in Syria. And I think it is in everybody's interests, the Syrian people, the region, the wider world, the fight against terrorism. It is in everybody's interest that that transition takes place, and that political transition takes place quickly. The sooner that happens, the sooner the people of Syria can be freed from the tyranny under which they're currently suffering.
There's David Cameron speaking there. Well, that's one point of view. Well, the Syrian point of view isn't quite so easy to find nowadays, because the Sana news agency, that's www.sana.sy, has been impossible to get on the internet for the last 24 hours or so. Martin,
don't forget that the Syrian government's TV station was attacked by the rebels, and they killed 7 journalists for saying things they didn't like.
Well, yes.
So it's all about controlling the media.
I mean, I'm certainly finding it quite difficult to get a Syrian point of view, because they have a very good English language news service, like I say, SANA, Syria Arab News Agency .sy, which has just been impossible to access for the last couple of days.
Why aren't we calling for regime change in Yemen? regime change in Saudi Arabia, regime change in Bahrain. I mean, that wretched regime in Bahrain shouldn't be there another second. They're repressing their people,
but
and
Martin,
if they don't get out of the way, there'll have to be a revolution from the bottom, and everybody will have to die.
But Martin,
I mean, come on, let's be logical here.
Supported by the West. And
oh,
by
indeed,
by NATO.
Indeed.
Anyway,
and that's what the Russians
I did have
are
a
saying.
Search around to see if I could find a comment from the Syrian government about all this. It wasn't very easy, but I did find a comment yesterday made at the United Nations by the Syrian ambassador to the UN.
Before every meeting of the Security Council on the situation in Syria, the Syrian people concerns increase and their tensions heighten. This is mainly ascribed to what we have been warning about for a long time, of a suspicious coincidence between these meetings and treacherous terrorist acts that have affected many of the innocent people of Syria, their institutions, their cadres, their human and material resources.
So, Martin, do you share his suspicion about the coincidence of bomb attacks with these UN Security Council meetings?
When the West is putting forward certain things at the UN Security Council, suddenly then the media picks up on various things that are happening in Syria. So this is a double whammy for Syria. We've knocked off your top security chiefs at the same time as bringing forward our Security Council resolution. The suspicion in Syria is that, for example, British intelligence may have been involved in this bomb attack. Now, of course, if British intelligence were involved in this bomb attack killing Syria's security chiefs, I think Britain's security chief should be looking under their cars in the morning, because it may be that the other side may decide that they're going to fight back, because if it's backs against the wall time, then anything goes, doesn't it? And people are playing with fire here. The British government's playing with fire, the Israelis are playing with fire, the Americans are playing with fire, and of course if you play with fire you get burned.
Okay, the other thing which struck me was that about 10 days ago, Hillary Clinton threatened a catastrophic assault against Syria. This bombing really kind of fulfills that.
Indeed.
And I mean, she's
mafiosi style politics.
She's using this strange imagery. She was saying the hourglass is running out. She almost sounds like the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz.
Well, I think the whole idea of talking up a war inside Syria is absolutely stupid. What the Russians are saying, if you read Sergei Lavrov's piece...
He's the Russian foreign minister.
Russian foreign minister. He's saying, look, we're not saying that Assad's got to stay or Assad's got to go. What we're saying to Assad is, for goodness sake, calm down and don't overreact to people provoking you. And what you should be saying, Western powers and Saudi Arabia, to your protégés, is, for goodness sake, let's have a ceasefire. And on the back of a ceasefire, then perhaps we can get a solution. I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia, and that's exactly what we were saying to all the warring parties. Stop shooting and let's talk about it. Now, the West has actually encouraged the Free Syrian Army and the Al-Qaeda groups that they're supporting, because they are supporting Al-Qaeda groups in Syria. There's loads of documentary evidence of that. And, of course, British people need to take note of that. So Al-Qaeda are our allies. We're giving them weapons and money. We always have been. We certainly are in Syria. We certainly did in Libya. And what they should be saying to their protégés is, calm down, let's have a political solution. Now, Assad just walking away is not a political solution. All the people who support him will then be completely disenfranchised. And don't forget, the main people supporting the Assad regime are the middle class in the main cities, because they've actually got a reasonably comfortable existence in Syria compared to Iraq, for example, where they've been decimated. The Christians, the Kurds, and the Shia Muslims. Now, in other words, this is a sectarian civil war very similar to Bosnia, and the West is taking sides. But if they want to take sides in other people's civil wars, watch out, because it all blows back in your face eventually.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
So now we come to the story that was at the top of the hour. The German spy chief Heinz Fromm has quit over neo-Nazi investigation scandal. This was in The Independent on Tuesday, last week actually. The head of the German intelligence was forced to resign amid explosive revelations that his agents deliberately destroyed and manipulated files containing information about a neo-Nazi terror cell behind the country's worst far-right violence since the Second World War. Heinz Fromm, who's 63, said he took responsibility for the actions of staff who shredded seven intelligence documents, and they left out key information from computer files and lied to their superiors at the height of an inquiry into neo-Nazi terrorists last November. Mr. Fromm, who resigned after 12 years at the helm of the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution, said the actions of the agents involved were unprecedented. Nothing like this has ever occurred before during my tenure, he said. It's a major breach of trust and hugely damaging to the reputation of the service. Well, the German Secret Service Martin, are gathering information on these neo-Nazi terror groups in Germany and then shredding the evidence. What on earth is going on?
Well, the head of the German Secret Service after the war was Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe. And in actual fact, the Nazis, many Nazi agents were recruited to the German Secret Services at the time, and many fascists were recruited to the Secret Services across Western Europe, because the policy was to reintegrate the Nazis into the Western security structure in order to fight the communists. And as we've mentioned on this show before, Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O, is the name of the operation by which all of this was done. And they were engaged in all kinds of terrorism in Western Europe, the Bologna bomb, the Dortmund beer hall massacre, Brabant massacres in Belgium, all of which were discovered by parliamentary inquiries in Switzerland, Belgium and in Italy to be carried out by the intelligence services. They've got a track record, as long as your arm, of carrying out terrorist attacks and then using it as a means to try and steer the politics of the countries concerned.
Well, this neo-Nazi...
This is not conspiracy theory, this is historical.
This neo-Nazi
fact.
Terror group is called the National Socialist Underground, the NSU. Over a decade, they murdered a female police officer, they shot dead 9 immigrants, injured more than 20 people in 2 bomb attacks, and robbed 14 banks to finance their operations. So why should the German Secret Service be shredding their files?
Because the German Secret Service is working with the Americans and the British on fomenting terrorism, Nazi terrorism, right-wing, left-wing terrorism, and possibly Muslim terrorism as well, because it's actually part of their game plan for steering us away from a democratic society into something more controlled. And they've been doing it for years. Anybody can check this by just putting a simple search into their computer, Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O. Daniel Ganser is a Swiss academic who's written a very good book on it. Richard Cottrell is a former Conservative MEP who's just written another very good book on it. Basically, it's bang to rights that the intelligence services in the West have been involved in terrorism for 30 or 40 years. It's about time people woke up to what we're dealing with.
Now, there's a film, isn't there, about the Gladio, made by the BBC Time Watch. This
Indeed.
Is directed and produced by...
Frankovich.
By Alan Frankovich, yes. So, is it... I mean, what is it in that film? It was a three-part series, I think, in 1992.
Yes, it was shown in 1993 on BBC Two in the Time Watch slot, a three-part film about Gladio. And basically, Frankovich, one of my heroes and yours, Tony, interviewed many of the principals involved in all of this, including the heads of the Secret Service and so on. And one of the things that sticks in my mind from the film was Vincenzo Vincinguerra, who was a fascist terrorist who'd been involved in all sorts of bombings and shootings in Italy, saying, well, you know, well, I'm not scared of being prosecuted by the state because the state doesn't prosecute the state. And I was working for the state. And many of the people involved were prepared to say what they'd been doing because they were getting old and they just wanted their role to be recognised. But in actual fact, there is no doubt about it, Western intelligence services, including MI6, have been involved in terrorism for a very long time.
Now, what about our own...
the Irish, they know.
What about our own counter-terrorism service, which is MI5, their Director General Jonathan Evans? Before this scandal about G4S security broke out, about a week and a half before it, he was on Channel 4 News saying there was the security for the Olympics was absolutely no problem with it. It was all fine. And the only thing we really need to worry about was the possible terrorist acts by the Iranians at the Olympics.
Which is an extraordinary thing for the head of MI5 to say. A, we shouldn't know who you are. B, you shouldn't be making statements. And C, if you thought it was the Iranians, you shouldn't say anything about it. But there's no evidence that the Iranians have done any such thing. I mean, this attack in Bulgaria, which Netanyahu immediately blamed on the Iranians, there's no evidence that the Iranians were involved. The Iranians have denied all involvement. In fact, it's against their interest to do something like that. We are being set up for a world war by crypto-fascist intelligence agencies. That's the fact of the matter. And people really need to wake up and realise the bankers are criminals, people running the intelligence services are terrorists. That's the real world. Wake up, people.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, from international terrorism to rather worrying stuff of a different sort, and I'm joined now by Mark Cambridge from Bristol Remploy. Hi, Mark, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for having us on the show.
Now, I understand that you have had some news from the report that was being done into Remploy about what's happening to the Bristol site. So can you bring us up to date?
Yes, there has been some change. There has been an expression of interest in the site in Remploy Bristol, but we have no idea who this may or may not be and what their intentions may or may not be.
But Mark, can't they just let you continue? Because you're actually making money as you are. I mean, if you could be rid of your head office, I mean, if you were just basically functioning as one specific unit, as one entity, as one business, you could be just carry on your own.
Yes, in an ideal world, that would be the case. But unfortunately, we have to realise there has been this review by Liz Sace at the back of end of October 2011, approaching 2012, and we have to take note of those recommendations. But even allowing for that and the decisions that have been made by the government since, we are extremely worried and extremely angry about the situation, and we really do need clarification of the issue regarding this expression of interest in our site and their intentions for us and the site.
Now, I'm also joined by Michelle Tyler. Hi, Michelle. Can you just tell us what you do at the Remploy site? Because, I mean, the whole idea was they set it up after World War II, didn't they?
Yeah.
In order to make sure that disabled people weren't kind of marginalised in society, and there was a specific place for anyone who's disabled to apply for a job which was tailor-made for them and also slightly supported by the state.
Yeah. Well, I do, like, prepping sort of work, office work.
What does that mean? For the rest of us, prepping, what's that?
Yes.
If I can butt in, basically what we do a combination of prepping, scanning and indexing for various companies of paper documents, which are converted into more eco-friendly.
Ah, right. Now, formats. This is what is going on right across the world right now, isn't it? Paper is being turned into electronic offices. So, Michelle, what's your feeling about the announcement that you may be able to stay, but they're not telling you who it is that would actually come in and buy it up? It must be a little bit nerve-wracking, actually.
Yeah, upset and worried and disappointed by the government. You know, they're just leaving you in the lurch all the time. You don't know where you stand.
For you, how has it actually affected you, not being sure whether you're going to be able to keep your job or not?
Like I said, I'm upset.
Okay. And what about you, Mark?
Well, there's extreme anger and concern right across the board. At the end of the day, we're all human beings. We've all got to our lives to lead, and we all need to know where we stand as far as this position is concerned. It is critical for all of us. We are very concerned about being two-peed across and our years of service not being recognised. We think this is very unfair, and we need these issues taken very careful note of by all parties concerned. And this is part of the reason why we took industrial action yesterday, and we are taking industrial action again next Thursday.
What is the point of actually going on strike? I mean, surely that actually makes things worse, doesn't it? I mean, I admit it, you want to find an outlet for your anger. The fact that you're feeling, I would imagine, bullied, really, by the government, saying, well, we're just going to decide whether you're going to be able to keep your job or not, even though you're still making money. Why did you actually decide to go on strike?
Well, naturally, we feel very frustrated by the whole process since the Liz Sace review at the back end of last year. And we feel we've been left with no alternative, really, because of the lack of communication concerning our site and the future for us. We felt it is the only way for us to make a point and to also raise awareness amongst the wider community, as many people throughout the Bristol area and beyond have no idea about what Remploy does and even have no idea whatsoever that they are actually contributing towards the funding of Remploy each financial year.
Okay, Michelle, what are your thoughts about the future then? Because, I mean, if they do sack you, how easy would you find it to get more work?
I won't, because I suffer from epilepsy, and I won't find another job, because who's going to take you on with epilepsy? Nobody.
And so what has actually working at Remploy done for you over the years?
It's gave me a job, and that it made me a lot of friends and colleagues and things like that.
I mean, do you find that you actually get support from other disabled people being around them in your workplace? Do you find it's actually quite a nice place to work? Because, I mean, there's a lot of people out there that actually would much rather just stay at home. They don't want to go to work. They'd much rather have the leisure time, maybe go out to the park rather than go to work every morning.
Oh, no, because it gets you up and everything, you know, and I just think it's disgusting how Remploy's shutting down in that lot. You know, I think it's, I can't describe it really, because I mean, I get angry all the time.
So how would you justify actually staying there? What do you think that you have got to offer for society?
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, what's the point of... I mean, because there's a government subsidy for it, isn't there? There's a, everybody's paying their taxes and a little bit goes to you. So what do we get for our money?
Well, at least we're paying our tax, like you said. But if you're out on the dole, you're not paying taxes, are you?
Now, this is another side to it, Mark, isn't it? Because if you're going onto the dole, the government's going to have to pay for you anyway, so it may as well pay for you in Remploy, surely.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree more, Tony. I feel that there is a mass contradiction going on here. We all know that the government has been consistently looking at the issue of the large numbers of people on long-term incapacity benefit over the last few years. We all know that they're looking to get large numbers of those people back into work. So quite clearly, if they're trying to do that on one hand and close Remploy on the other hand, it just proves beyond all reasonable doubt there is a mass contradiction and there has been a lack of careful thought and consideration into this whole issue of Remploy and the employment of people with disabilities.
So what can listeners do if they feel sympathy and want to help you out? I mean, for me, it feels a bit fascist, actually, for a government to actually put you guys on the dole when actually they should be, by even paying less money, they're keeping you in work. It seems almost, it doesn't really make any economic sense, and it seems like the disabled people are just simply being bullied.
Yeah, exactly. I think part of the problem is that we are a small minority in a large pot in this country, and I do feel, to a degree, deep down in my heart and my mind, that we are still looked upon as the little people that can easily be rolled over, and I think that's got to stop. We've really got to get ourselves together here, get our act together, speak up for ourselves, stand up for ourselves, and take our fight forward. And
so you're striking again next Thursday. Can people come down? Will you have any sort of picket line or presence there?
We're looking to raise as much awareness of our situation as possible. It's critical. We're in a country of roughly a population of somewhere between 55 and 60 million. We need as many people to know about our issue as possible and to support us.
Okay, so can you tell us where you are?
Yeah, we're actually based in St Phillips Road, Kings and Trading Estate, Bristol, which is just 5-minute walk from the Bristol to Bath psychopath and the recycling unit.
It's near Old Market, isn't
That's
it? It's just south of Old Market.
Yes.
At the eastern end of Old Market. So if anyone wants to come down, what time next Thursday?
Any time during the day next Thursday. They're more than welcome to come down and give us their support. It would be greatly appreciated. It is critical now that we raise as much awareness as possible throughout the whole country of our situation. And get as many people to support us as possible. They can also support us through various websites, i.e. Facebook, Twitter, Unite, the GMB. Go on there, follow the links, perhaps even Google search Remploy. You'll soon find out about what's been going on here. And if you would back us, put a message online and just get your message across on behalf of all of us, because we would really appreciate it.
Fantastic.
We really do need your support.
Fantastic,
and
Mark. And if you don't know where those websites are, if you go to the Friday Drive Time website later on this evening or any time over the weekend, I'll make sure I put those links up for people. That's website is at www.thisweek.org.uk. We'll take you straight to the page for this show on the BCFM website. And so Michelle Tyler and Mark Cambridge from Bristol Remploy, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tony.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, this week we had a visitor in Bristol from Hong Kong. Sally Tang was in town on Tuesday evening, and I spoke to her earlier this week on Tuesday night about what was going on in China at the moment and in Hong Kong particularly.
My name is Sally Tang, and I'm from the CWI in Hong Kong, Socialist Action. I'm coming to speak about China and Hong Kong, the mass struggle, which is uprising in Hong Kong and China right now. Before 1997, Hong Kong was the colony of British rule. This year, it was the 15 years of the return from Hong Kong to China. On the 1st of July, 2 weeks ago, it was the anniversary, and 400,000 people protest, demonstrate on the streets against the Chinese Communist Party because they are really scared, afraid if the Chinese Communist Party will have big repression and then they take out the democratic rights of the Hong Kong people. That is why people went on the streets, and also because the new chief executive, CY Leung, is going on office on the 1st of July. That is why people are so angry. In Hong Kong, there's no universal suffrage and people cannot vote for who they want. CY Leung, he's the new chief executive, and the propaganda and a lot of media, they try to make it like an election on the TV, on every TV program. But of course, people in Hong Kong are really angry that we don't have a right to vote. Only 1,200 people can vote for the chief executive. But the 1,200 people are mainly capitalists, which are not stand for the benefit and the rights for the people. That is why people are so angry about that.
So do you think it's fair to say that people in Hong Kong feel betrayed by the English, by the way they just handed it over to the Chinese without democracy?
Whoever is ruling, the British government or the Chinese Communist Party is ruling us. They don't stand for our rights and they don't stand on the benefit of the 99% because they are the ruling class and they are the 1% and they will not fight for our rights. The people, the 99%, have to come out for the working class and for our own rights. Yes.
Okay, tell us about the other uprisings that's been going on in China, because it's not really been reported in the Western press.
In mainland China, most of the mass struggle are repressed by the police because it's illegal to demonstrate on the street. Mass incident in China is increasing dramatically in the recent years. For example, in 2005, there were only 20,000 mass incident. But after 2006, the government has stopped to announce the number of mass incident because it's too many. And we can see it from recent years. For example, last year, there were 180,000 mass incident in mainland China. And if we only count worker strike, there are 100,000 worker strike in mainland China. Every day, there are 300 worker strike in China happening. One of the struggle which is really famous internationally is the Wuhan struggle happened last year. More than 30,000 villagers, they have kicked out the officials of the Chinese Communist Party ordinary leaders in the government, and then they have had their own election, and then they have formed their own government during that struggle. Their struggle lasts for 3 months. This is a really big step forward. It shows that people and the working class have their own power to self-management, and then they can form their own government. But of course, the government had big repression at the beginning. But then the government has a fake election with the people, and then this movement was defeated after that. So we can see the demands for democracy in mainland China is really big, that they cannot stand the dictatorship anymore.
We've heard about, over the last few months, the scandal with Bo Xilai. I mean, can you give us your insight into what's been happening right at the top of Chinese politics?
I believe that the fall of Bo Xilai affair was a very big scandal and of the whole Chinese Communist Party. And it is also a very big news internationally in the Western media. There is a shift to the right within the Chinese Communist Party as the fall of Bo Xilai. But we need to stress that Bo Xilai is nothing standing for Maoism or the left. When he was ruling Liaoning or when he was ruling Chongqing, he has done a lot of privatization and he has attracted a lot of foreign investment into China. It shows that he is only a populist with using Maoist slogans, but in fact he's nothing he's not a communist at all. The fall of Bo Xilai is an attempt from the liberal wing, which Wang Jiabao is representing. The liberal wing is trying to attack on the princeling really hard because the liberal wing is trying to carry out more privatization and to break up the monopoly of the state-owned enterprise, which are mostly controlled on the hands of the princelings. This is an internal power struggle. Since 1989, for 23 years, they have never been so big crisis like now, because they cannot hide, they cannot cover this crisis anymore because it's so big. The split from the ruling class, the split from the top, can give more rooms for people from the bottom and the working class and the mass to organize and unite to fight against the dictatorship.
To fight against the dictatorship of China. Well, that's Sally Tang. She was speaking at Cheltenham Road Library Tuesday evening this week, and she's from Hong Kong. Martin, she talked there about the princelings, who are sort of almost like the guardians of the big old state-owned industries from the communist past.
Well, the princelings are, in fact, I mean, what you've got is an old guard there that, you know, marches on the long march and they're all in their 90s or whatever, but it's their sons and daughters who are referred to as the princelings because, of course, they are, you know, the ones with what they call Guangxi connections, and they, you know, they're the ones who can set up in business, they have a charmed life, they get all the best university places and so on. It sounds a bit like Britain, doesn't it? But that's what she means by the princelings. We have our own princelings here, of course, but they're not communists.
Okay, and we had a big demonstration there, 400,000 people on the streets of Hong Kong, really protesting about the state of which they've been left in by Chris Patten, who was the governor there during the changeover. Now, he, of course, is now the chairman of trustees at the BBC.
Well, yes, I mean, it was always going to be a tricky one, wasn't it? Let's face it. You know, the decolonisation is always a messy.
But I mean, but wasn't it beholden on us to at least leave some kind of vestige of proper democracy there when we left?
Well, the Chris Patten would say that we did leave some vestige, and in actual fact, you see, Sally Tang there is obviously a kind of left-wing socialist who's opposed to the Communist Party. She's from Hong Kong, and she feels perfectly happy to say those kind of things. If she's from mainland China, she'd probably find it more difficult to say those kind of things. So Hong Kong is, in fact, more free than mainland China, but of course it's not free, but then where's free?
Quite amazing, though, to hear about that town where there's a town of 30,000 people where they just decided we don't like the corrupt Communist Party here. So they actually just kicked them out of town and had their own elections and elected their own people to run the town for 3 months until it was repressed by the party.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's an authoritarian system. I mean, it's all very well us sitting here in a studio in Bristol trying to second guess what's going on in China, which is a huge place, and one in four people in the world is Chinese. They've got 120 cities bigger than London or something. I mean, it's an enormous place, a huge, huge place. It's very easy to try and, you know, very hard to generalise about it. But ultimately, I would hope that you would see democracy arriving in China by steps rather than through upheaval. As we're seeing in the Middle East, upheaval can be very messy.
But she's talking about upheaval there. She's saying that over the last 5 or 6 years, there's been a massive increase in street demonstrations, which are totally illegal, and it's happening everywhere.
Well, indeed,
and
also, of course, the economy in China is starting to wobble because their export markets are drying up. They need 8% growth a year just to soak up the existing workforce, the growth in the existing workforce. And once the deal that after Tiananmen Square between the Communist Party and the ordinary people was, leave politics to us and we will make you prosperous. And while the economy was booming, people forgot about politics and got on with, you know, becoming more prosperous and let the communists carry on running the show.
I suppose the ultimate
question... But, of course, once the economies can't deliver economic prosperity anymore, then that deal is off.
The ultimate question, though, I suppose, is which way is China going? Is it going more down the pro-Russian route or the pro-US route? These are the three major superpowers.
It's also a big player in its own right, so that, in other words, they can actually generate enough waves to make the Russians and the Americans... I mean, don't forget, they own America's national debt. They could at any moment crash the US economy just by flicking their fingers if they chose to do so. So everywhere these days. Nowhere is remote, and we're not remote from China. China's not remote from us.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, now I'm joined by Kevin Phillips from the Avon and Somerset Police Federation. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. How are you doing?
Okay. Now, your leaflet, which you've got there, it talks about robbery. We are being robbed, apparently, of £20 million. Now, that's, I imagine, £20 million that could be paying for our police, paid for by central government taxation, but isn't.
Yeah, I mean, basically, to try and explain it quite simply, every year the police authority is given a policing grant. Out of that policing grant, a percentage of that is being taken back by the government and being redistributed to other forces around the country. That equates to approximately £20 million a year at the moment, which equals 450 police officers that Avon and Somerset could have on the street.
Now, so why this subtracting this £20 million from our budget? How do they justify it?
Well, they say that forces around the country actually need that money more than what we do. Now, clearly it's what we would class as an unfair tax. It's the residents of Avon and Somerset that pay their council tax to the police authority, etc., to police their streets, but this has been redistributed elsewhere in the country.
But, I mean, surely the quid pro quo here is that because we don't have as much crime as somewhere else in the country, it's better to spend that money somewhere where there is more crime and employ more police officers in somewhere where crime's a bigger problem. In a way, we're a victim of our own lack of criminality.
I would probably suggest that the actual amount of crime that comes into it is not the reason for this money being taken away. As I say, it is a formula that the government brought in back in 2005-2006. Avon and Somerset Police Authority have probably lost about £100 million over that period. You imagine how many police officers that would be.
Okay, now what are you doing about it? So I know you've got some sort of an online petition. Where can we find that?
Yeah, I mean, basically, ourselves and Avon and Somerset Police Authority have decided to launch this e-petition. Now, if anybody wants to actually sign up to this, this is actually on the Police Authority website, Avon and Somerset Police Authority website. It's straightforward. You just go on there, you sign it, and that goes towards getting the government to actually listen to what we're saying. As we say, it's 450 police officers this year we could have on our streets. If we don't want the police officers, it's worth £40 to £50 back to each resident of Avon and Somerset.
Well, it might be something that a new police and crime commissioner, because they're being elected, although this has been very little publicity about it, but apparently we're going to have a complete shift in the way that our police are governed. That is the sort of way that the democratic accountability kind of kicks in. At the moment, we've got a police authority which has got lay members. It's got councillors from various parts of the Avon and Somerset area, like Bristol and Somerset, etc. Can you just explain to us, is there any real justification for changing this? The idea being that this one person, a bit like the mayor, is elected. How is that actually going to affect the way that the police is run?
I think if we go back to a saying that my father used to say, which was, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I think that's the issue. The police authority do a very good job. They work very well. The police constabulary are accountable to the police authority. Now we're going to have one person that's actually running the show, and whether that's going to work, I don't know. It will be interesting.
Martin Summers, what are your thoughts about this idea? Because essentially it's a bit like Commissioner Gordon in Batman. You know, they had police commissioners in the United States. This is basically a US
idea.
Well,
they're also bringing in Tom Windsor, who's made such a mess of the railways, to run the police at the central level. I mean, the whole idea seems to be that we've got to shake up public services, including the police service, because they're hidebound, they're stuck in a rut, they don't know enough about how the private sector operates and all the rest of it. But I would have thought, in policing in particular, it is such a specialised area that people, you know, you come up through the ranks, you start off as a beat bobby and you work your way up. I don't think anybody from outside is necessarily going to understand what the issues are sufficiently to be able to manage in that way. And Tom Windsor's been brought in as a manager. And, of course, the police commissioner thing is actually politicising the police. The police authority has got a variety of different political parties represented on it and different communities represented. And of course, there are different views about policing in different sections of the community, and that the police need to hear all of those views, don't they? Not just one person who's been elected possibly on 30% of the vote. What the Conservatives are hoping here, of course, is that the people in the inner cities won't bother to vote. It'll be the people in the leafy shires who will go out and vote for a tough police commissioner who will then tell the police to do X, Y, and Z to get tough on whatever. And of course, that's actually taking away the police's independence of judgment about what they should and shouldn't be doing. An individual elected like that is going to be much more pushy than a committee of people with representing a variety of views.
But the argument, Kevin, is that the police authority is almost invisible. No one even knows it's there. It's been meeting, for example, up at the castle, you know, the Portishead, Avon and Somerset Police Headquarters up on top of the hill. Whereas, really, I mean, it's an organisation that should be, and it's the public are allowed to go along to the police authority. It's the sort of thing that should really have been meeting in the city here, so it's much more accessible to people.
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily fall out with that, and I think that is something that the police authority do look at. I think, just picking back up on Martin's point, these elections are going to take place on some wet, windy evening in November. How many people are actually going to go out there and vote? It's going to be very, very easy for some extremist party to actually gather enough votes. And then you never know who's going to be in charge of the police, you know, police and commissioner.
We've just spent 30 years in Northern Ireland trying to depoliticise the police so that both communities and everybody else will accept that the police are above the political fray. And then we've got these nitwits saying, I know, why don't we politicise policing? It's like, because it's stupid. Police should be seen to be non-political, and you're turning it into a political football. And of course, if you do that, you may end up with it as a political football, and then what are you going to do?
Well, I suppose we could have one candidate that's already on the police authority that would just run it as if it was the police authority again, invite councillors and run it in the old-fashioned way. So there's just a possibility. Anyway, Kevin, you've got something like 3,000 members in Avon and Somerset Police Federation. Can you just tell us how you make decisions? Because are you actually democratic, or, you know, is it just a one or two police that make the decisions in the federation?
Well, as a police federation, we are very democratic, and quite ironic that actually today I've spent all day in what we call our joint branch board meeting. This is part and parcel of our system, the way we work it. Federation reps are elected throughout their districts and areas and departments. They represent the people on the ground, and it works its way up, so you eventually have an executive and you have the joint branch boards. We have all three ranks represented, or all four ranks represented.
And what are they?
Constables, sergeants, inspectors and chief inspectors for federated ranks. Now, they are all represented on the joint branch board. They have their say. The say is there. And, you know, we do have votes, as we had today, on a number of issues that we had to deal with.
Okay, do you want to tell us about any? Is there anything interesting that you were talking about today you want to share with our listeners?
Probably not at the moment, because quite a lot of that is on minutes that haven't been dealt with yet. But, you know, I mean, I suppose we could discuss clearly the story that I've got to commend you for, which is the G4S one, that has been a big talking point for us. You know, this shows what happens if you try and privatise policing. If we go down this route, where do we go? We've got G4S. It's a total debacle at the moment. I think Theresa May is what I would class as Teflon. She's non-stick. She should be accountable for this. I think last week she actually said that she'd only found out a couple of days prior to last week's announcement. Today's press is clearly saying she actually knew 2 weeks ago.
But ultimately, for you, what difference is it being employed by the police authority or being employed by G4S?
Well, I think if we were, you know, as it is at the moment, we're employed as police officers. We are Crown servants. You know, we are not employees. Now, if we start giving or start going down the route of us being privatised, then we have to become employees, which then creates all sorts of issues with, as we know, industrial action, strikes, work to rule.
Not turning up for work, not getting trained.
Not turning up for work, exactly. I think you've just about covered that one perfectly.
I mean, that's one of the most amazing things for me about this G4S business was the fact that because the story was out there, a lot of people who had actually been trained and signed up just decided that it wasn't worth it and they weren't going to turn up for work, that they didn't feel confident working for that organisation. I mean, how do you think this is going to affect G4S's attempts to privatise the police in the future? Because we heard about a month ago in The Guardian, the front page, G4S's boss announcing that within 5 years he would be running if not every police service, it was saying in 5 years' time, all of our police will be run by private firms.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting, actually, because I'm aware that G4S have made a number of bids for privatisation of certain policing areas.
Yeah, so West Midlands, I think, was one of the first to go. I mean, actually, Avon and Somerset were one of the first to privatise its police civilian support services, and that, in many respects, hasn't gone too well. It's sort of problems in the background going on. So, ultimately, what does this mean? Like I say, what does this mean for G4S into the future?
Well, I think G4S's reputation has totally gone down the pan, if I'm totally honest. With regards to privatising police, I would hope this is a lesson learned for the government. They can look at this and think, actually, it ain't going to work. You know, if we go down this route, we are going to create more and more problems.
Okay, Martin, can you just sum up here the G4S debacle, which we had a bit to do with about 4 weeks ago, I think, on this programme, with a 40-minute interview that then went viral online. Do you think that this is going to stop this move to privatise? Is it a privatisation too far?
Well, one would hope so. I mean, as you know, Tony, we tipped off people in the police service and the army about all of this weeks ago.
You're the National Policing Improvement Agency, who sort of oversee policing, yeah.
And G4S, of course, isn't just operating in this country. They're the second biggest company in the world, apparently, after Walmart. They've got massive security contracts in Israel, for example. They run political prisons in Israel, where they're holding Palestinian prisoners. Now, I asked myself, are these people appropriate to be policing the Olympic Games? because in actual fact they're not necessarily a British-based company with loyalties to Britain. They're an international security company like Blackwater. And of course this whole area of private security is becoming extremely dubious. We saw in Iraq lots of mercenaries basically running rampage with no kind of accountability whatsoever. We don't want to see that on the streets of Britain. I think, hopefully this debacle will lead to a rethink in the government about taking on the police and the police federation about this privatisation issue. And hopefully, as Kevin said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
OK, Kevin, your petition, could you just remind us where it is online?
It's actually on the Avon and Somerset Police Authority website. It's clearly marked there. All people need to do is go onto that website and they will be directed in the right direction.
Okay, Kevin Phillips from Avon Somerset Police Federation, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Drive Time on BCFM 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now I'm joined by Dave Regwell, who's from an organisation called CERA. But before we speak to Dave, Martin, we've talked about this McNulty report before, haven't we, which is to do with the changing of the privatised railways, giving them a bit more freedom to charge what they want.
Well, yes. I mean, it's just the whole privatisation of the railways, if you look at it objectively, was a bad mistake. It should never have been done. It was at the fag end of the last Conservative government, if you remember, and basically it's been a disaster. And ultimately, I think it's now being talked about in Labour Party circles that it's all going to have to be taken back into public ownership. Pretty obvious, really, to those who've been watching.
Now, Dave Regwell, you're from CERA. First of all, what is CERA? What does it stand for?
CERA basically is the green wing of the Labour Party. So we look at policies to do with the environment, social inclusion, and social policy.
Okay. Well, what about you and your interest in railways? Why are you interested in railways? What's your background?
Why am I interested in railways? Well, I've worked in the railway industry for only 25 years.
Okay. What have you done in the railway? Because, I mean, it's nice to have someone who's actually got practical experience campaigning on something.
I've been involved in city trains. I've been involved in high-speed train management and maintenance procedures. I've been involved in local trains in the north of England, management of those, and I've been involved in local trains in Scotland under a whole different ethos of operating under British Rail.
So you've seen the transition to privatisation. How has everything changed? How did it change behind the scenes, I suppose, is what I'm getting at?
It didn't change that drastically as far as the staff on the ground were concerned, because what happened was the government set up units, and those units were effectively units that were then set out for compulsory competitive tendering. So they set up the Great Western Trains business in this part of the world, or where I was in that particular time in Scotland, and then they went out for compulsory competitive tendering, and transport companies then bid to run those businesses. And in the former Scotland, it was National Express who took over Scotland's railways.
Now, Martin's just talked there about the possibility of a new Labour government actually renationalising the railways. Is there anything to be gained from that, in your experience?
Well, it won't be renationalised in the way that British Railways Board was talked about. That is not on the cards. What they're really looking at is the structures around more intercity businesses going back to be run by a business like in France or in Germany, and the local train network being managed by local transportation authorities like they are in Greater Manchester or are in Merseyside or are effectively in the north. So they're looking at devolution of the local trains and maintaining a strong intercity business. Now, the issue there is, do you bring track and trains back together again? And at the moment, what we have is Network Rail, which is a national track authority, and signalling authority, which is government-owned. All its shares are all owned by the government. They're a not-for-profit company. They plough their profits back and are allowed to borrow off the government's borrowing requirements. So they borrow off the books. And bringing track and trains together is an interesting scenario.
Well, it sounds a bit bizarre that track and trains are not managed together.
Well, they are managed together through joint control units, and the last Labour government set up lots of joint control units. So you have the operators and Network Rail now sitting in the same buildings, operating as one business effectively. And just recently we've seen South West Trains and Network Rail come together as one business under a new company called London and South Western Railways. So we are going back the question at the moment is that the person who really decides what trains run in this part of the world is the Department for Transport. They actually specify all your local trains, they specify your fares, and they effectively tell the operators what to do and how many carriages to supply.
Now, we're looking at the moment at this McNulty report with a massive demanning, that is, even less people on our trains and on our stations, and a hike in prices. How have they managed to justify that? Because you'd think if they're getting rid of staff, the prices should go through the floor.
No, because what the government's doing at the moment is using the 3% a year increase in fares to pay for the investment programme from 2014 to 2019. So whilst about 4 billion of that will come from the taxpayer, the rest will come from the fare payer. And as we know, we've had eye-watering fare increases cut back last January, but if we go ahead this year, there'll be more eye-watering fare increases, mainly on the intercity network, I stress, not necessarily on the local
train.
But
that means less people are going to use the train, doesn't it?
Well, at the moment, trains are packed to capacity. We can't get more people on the trains. They stand in the rush hour around the Greater Bristol area. We've had extra carriages from the Department for Transport for First Great Western, and the Severn Beach Line has had nearly 90% growth in its local. It's 32% on what we've got already. So it's really at capacity. The only next thing we can do around the Bristol area is start to invest in more tracks and more trains and more infrastructure.
Okay, and is there any prospect of that? Do you think, what's the prospect in looking into the future around Bristol for trains?
I think the prospects under the government's announcements that came out the other day.
Now, what were they?
Well, there's two.
Remind me.
There was two. There was the city deal, which obviously is a deal between central government, that's Nick Clegg's office, and the four Greater Bristol authorities, and that will involve investment in the Portishead line, investment in the Henbury loop.
So how long until we start seeing passenger trains running to Portishead then?
Oh, I predict 2016, 2017 for the first passenger trains down to Portishead.
Oh, OK. Well, that's fascinating. Well, Dave, thanks very much for joining us. It's all the serious talk then out of the way for this evening, because Friday night is music night, kicking off with 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That's Labour Party's candidate for Mayor of Bristol, Marvin Rees. Thanks to Michelle Tyler and Mark Cambridge from CIRA, and also to Dave Regwell, who you just heard from there, and to Martin's old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers, and to Kevin Phillips from the Avon Somerset Police Federation. Next week, not sure what's on next week. We shall see. A lot can happen in a week. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's 5-point recovery plan. Just go to www.thisweek.org.uk, which will take you straight to this show and also to our archives. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Music this week is from the late 1970s. Do please join us for Friday drive time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.